This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, May 9th, 2012. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, Alexander the Great meets the Tree of Life. On this program, we're going to hear a poem called The Speaking Tree by Muriel Rukeyser. Rukeyser was born in 1913 into a wealthy Jewish family in New York City. And by the time she died in 1980, she had become a model for the poet as social activist. A lot of her poetry is politically and socially driven, but a lot of it is not. In 1976, a few years before she died, she gave a reading in Philadelphia. On the program with Rukeyser was Gerald Stern, relatively unknown at the time, but now one of our most celebrated poets. In the April 2012 issue of Poetry Magazine, Gerald Stern recounts meeting Rukeyser for the first time at this reading in Philly, and he joins me by phone from his home in New Jersey to tell us about it. Jerry, before you'd met Rukeyser, you'd been reading her work for years.
Well, sure. She was part of that generation of Lowell and Jarrell and Rethke. Mm-hmm. And my view of it is that the male poets of that generation were not kind to her. They probably were critical of her for all kinds of reasons, that she was outspoken, that she was bisexual probably, that she was a social activist, and that she was not obedient.
But you liked her. What did you like
about her? I loved her. I loved her from the beginning.
Tell me why.
I liked her because I identified with it. I loved the social, you call it social activism, that's a good word. Mm-hmm. I loved it for that reason. I loved it for its courage, for its originality, its radicalism, its irony, its address to the self and making the self culpable as well as present, not aggrandizing herself, not presenting herself necessarily as a hero or heroine. And I identified with that.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what it was like when you first met her in 1976.
Oh, boy. I was living at that time about 50 miles or 60 miles from Philadelphia, and there was a reading that night at the Walnut Street Theater on Walnut Street, probably on the fifth floor, a long, narrow room, and I was the unknown poet who was to read with the famous Muriel Rukeyser. It was a very large crowd, and they came mainly to see her, and she tested me out. She called me Mr. Poet, I think, and she said, you know, I'm going to read first. I said, not on your life. She had already been afflicted with diabetes and other ailments, and she kept dropping pages of her poems on the floor, but rather than pick them up, she would just freelance. She would temporize, you know, and make her poems up out of thin air.
Oh, really? She didn't have them memorized? She would just keep...
She would keep talking as if she were reading the poem. She sort of made things up. It was just quite beautiful. The audience adored her. Uh-huh. And the one thing I mentioned in that article is there was a pest at that reading who kept prodding me about my, quote, Jewish vision, whatever that is. This is after we both had read. I tried to answer him, and he kept insisting. And finally, I said, sotto voce, I don't want to be mean. And she said, sotto voce, be mean, be mean. And I loved her for it.
So you became friends with Muriel Rukeyser, and then she was asked to blurb a book of yours.
Yeah, Jonathan probably got in touch with her.
Jonathan Galassi, your publisher.
Yeah.
And then you went up to try to discourage her from blurbing her book.
Well, she had had another mini stroke. She had many of them. And I wanted to free her from that. So I knocked on her door. She knew I was coming. She was alone in this small apartment for some reason or other, lying in bed in a very thin rayon or slip. And she said, take me into the kitchen, make me some tea, which I did. She put a shawl over her shoulders. And she said, this is what I'm going to say. And she had it memorized. And there was a mistake, a slight mistake, you know, in usage or grammar, who cares, in the second line. I didn't want to even mention it to her, but it was indeed printed that way.
And you ended up writing a poem about the experience of going to her apartment that day.
Yes, I did a couple of years ago, and it's actually in my book of poems called Save the Last Dance.
Now, normally I don't like to hear poems over the phone, but could you read that one for us?
I will. It's pretty short.
Okay.
It's called Rukeyser. A visit with Muriel in her New York apartment, helping her into the kitchen, making her tea, freeing her from a statement. But she knew it by heart and wouldn't listen, though there was a rupture somewhere in the second sentence. And we were alone for an hour until her nurse came back and scolded her for leaving her bed and sitting with only a loosely knitted shawl over her shoulders and only a thin slip to cover her, a silk or rayon. And when the subject was murder and lying, there was a look of abandonment to her, as it was when she let her poems fall on the floor in Philadelphia in the long, narrow theater on Walnut Street. But I never finished my tea, and I escaped before the nurse could get to me. And I turned west, for the record, near Lexington, I think, against the sun, for it was March already.
You got it all in there.
Yeah. I loved her. I loved her.
Yeah. We have four or five audio poems of Muriel Rukeyser reading her own poems up on our site, poetryfoundation.org. And I asked you to choose one for this program. And you chose The Speaking Tree.
Right.
Why that poem?
I thought it would lend itself. It's mysterious still to me.
It is.
And I don't totally understand it.
Me neither.
Also, it's beautiful.
Is there anything that you can say to help prepare listeners?
It's called The Speaking Tree, and a figure keeps appearing in each of three stanzas. It's Alexander the Great, and it's startling. What appears to be a tree is a composition of people coiled in the trunks and branches, kind of terrifying in its way.
This poem is called The Speaking Tree, and goes with a legend of an island to which came Alexander the Great. Great Alexander sailing was from his true course turned by a young wind from a cloud in Asia, moving like a most recognizable, most silvery woman. Tall Alexander to the island came. The small breeze blew behind his turning head. He walked the foam of ripples into this scene. The trunk of the speaking tree looks like a tree trunk until you look again. Then people and animals are ripening on the branches. The broad leaves are leaves. Pale horses, sharp, fine foxes blossom. The red rabbit falls ready and running. The trunk coils, turns, snakes, fishes. Now the ripe people fall and run, three of them in their shore dance, flames that stand where reeds are creatures and the foam is flame. Stiff Alexander stands. He cannot turn, but he is free to turn. This is the speaking tree. It calls your name. It tells us what we mean.
That was Muriel Rukeyser reading The Speaking Tree, which was recorded in 1962 at the Library of Congress. Go ahead, Jerry.
When she reads it, what occurs to me is the rhythm, the syntax and such of the poem. It seemed when I read it to myself, because I never read it aloud, that we were dealing with a kind of loose I am line.
Yeah.
The trunk of the speaking tree looks like a tree trunk. Or leaves, pale horse, basically. But it seems now to be in two separate strophes. Every line is divided into two speaking parts. So, for example, the first line, Great Alexander, sailing from his true course turned, the second.
Great Alexander sailing was from his true course turned by a young wind from a cloud in Asia, moving like a most recognizable, most silvery woman.
It's almost Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, the lines, some of them are physically broken up and with space.
And some of them are physically broken up to lend a force to that.
Tall Alexander to the island came. The small breeze blew behind his turning head. He walked the foam of ripples into this scene. The trunk of the speaking tree looks like a tree trunk until you look again.
So here's a poem where the most powerful person in the world, Alexander the Great, encounters a tree that seems to be the source of life itself.
It's a magic island.
Sure.
It's out of the Tempest, you know.
Yeah.
but it goes beyond what Shakespeare constructed. It is magic in and of itself.
Then people and animals are ripening on the branches. The broad leaves are leaves. Pale horses, sharp, fine foxes blossom. The red rabbit falls ready and running.
Ready and running, meaning he's ripe.
Yeah.
It's like a peach or a pear falling from a tree, and it's already ripe, ready to eat. In this case, a rabbit is ready to be a rabbit.
Now the ripe people fall and run.
This is another version of Genesis, you know.
Three of them in their shore dance.
And yeah, then they dance. Three of them in their shore dance.
Flames that stand where reeds are creatures, and the foam is flame. Stiff Alexander stands.
And he's watching this, and he doesn't understand it, and it finally ends. He's by this time not Great Alexander, but Stiff Alexander.
Yeah, what do you make? So the poem begins, Great Alexander, then Tall Alexander, and then at the end, Stiff Alexander. It's as if he becomes
a transformation into
a statue.
Yeah, himself, or into helplessness and awe and maybe fear.
He cannot turn, but he is free to turn.
If he wanted to, he could get rid of that. I'd see it as male ego in a certain way, from a feminist point of view.
Well, what about power, just sheer power? He was the most, at the time...
He was the most powerful man in the world.
Yeah.
But suddenly he's stiff.
Mm-hmm.
He can't turn, even though he's free to turn. Mm. And she says...
This is the speaking tree. It calls your name.
Of course, that means all of us, particularly Alexander.
Yeah.
And then it ends up with this ambiguous statement.
It tells us what we mean.
Not that it tells us what to do... It tells us what we mean.
Yeah.
Which can be translated in a thousand ways. It tells us how, not what to believe, but how to believe, perhaps.
Or it could be saying that it's poetry that tells us what we mean.
That's very good. I hadn't thought about that, but that's exactly correct. And, you know, here's a great politician confronting poetry.
Confronting not just poetry, but confronting life itself.
And Alexander was so bent... As CEOs are, and poets themselves are, and so on, so bent on success and such a monolithic vision that he didn't stop for a minute. God knows he didn't know he would die. Was it 26? I think, I don't remember.
Mm, pretty young, yeah.
And he was just going his way.
So this is, in a sense, even though it's not overtly political or social, you can read a political meaning into it.
I see it as in the broadest sense of the word political. And may I just say this quickly,
mm-hmm.
talking about Rukeyser, dear Adrian Rich, who died a week ago, said many times, I could not have done what I did were it not for Muriel Rukeyser.
Mm.
She paved the way.
Gerald Stern, thanks so much.
It's great talking to you, Curtis. Thank you.
You can read poems by Muriel Rukeyser and by Gerald Stern on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Gerald Stern's latest is a book of essays called Stealing History. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. You can subscribe to this podcast in the iTunes store, where you can also write a review. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.